Today's Tay Show will be on Case 28 in the P.N. Lu, the Blue Rock Collection. Case 28 is entitled, What the Holy Ones Have Not Preached. Main subject. Nansen came to see Hyakujo Nehan Osho. Joe said, Is there any Dharma that the holy ones have not preached to the people? Nansen said, There is. Joe said, What is the Dharma that has not been preached to the people? Nansen said, It is not mind, it is not Buddha, it is not things. Joe said, You have just preached. Nansen said, I am like this. How about you? Joe said, I am not a man of great wisdom. How can I tell if there is preaching or no preaching? Nansen said, I don't follow you. Joe said, I've talked quite enough for you. Secho's verse. Ancestors and Buddhas have not preached, yet monks run after preachers. Clear mirror on a stand, sharply imaging, looking southward, see the great bear. The shaft hangs down, where do you find it? Saving your nostrils, you have lost your mouth. Thank you so much for coming to practice Zen this morning. We've had some very deep sitting in this room, and I thank you all for that. And I'm glad everybody could be here with your busy schedules. I know that it's not always easy to take the time out for this. So thank you. One way to think about life is that we are on a journey to know ourselves, right? This seems to be the direction that we're headed, whether we want to be or not. You know, when we're little kids, you know, we get instructions from people about how to be a certain person. So, you know, when I was growing up, I was given a name before I got to choose it. And I remember going to school, and when I was in school, I was the only kid whose name was Kurt, with a K-U-R, you know, K. And I always felt odd. I went to a school in Baltimore, Yorkwood Elementary School. And I think there was a guy whose name was, his name was Doug. And he was like a year or two older than I was. And everything about him seemed to be so, he just seemed to be so together. He seemed to be so cool or so perfect. You know, the way he dressed, first of all, I think he was a good-looking young man. And he was 2 years older than I was, but he seemed so much older. I don't think I called him sir, but I felt like calling him sir. And you know, he had a baseball cap, and he had a jacket and blue jeans or something. And I just thought, you know, I wish I were Doug, and I wish in my whole heart that I could be like Doug. Somehow I don't remember how we met, but you know, he asked me my name, and you know, I said Kurt, and it was like he sort of like what? What's that? You know, Kurt. He hadn't really heard the name Kurt, and this was before Kurt Vonnegut and so on. So now Kurt is better known, but at that time, that was in the 60s. You know, it was a strange name. And I had no friends named Kurt. I'd never met anybody named Kurt. And I wanted so much to be Doug, you know. But I was Kurt. And, you know, I grew up admiring all these other people. I remember when I was in the third grade, there was another kid that his name, he actually was a Chinese-American kid. His name was John Lee. His father was Chinese and his mother was American. And in the third grade, John Lee was like the star athlete of our elementary school. And he had a father who actually like played with him. So they would practice throwing a football, and John could throw a football really far. He was just a little kid, but he could throw a football really far. And I was not very athletically inclined, you know. When I would throw the football, it wouldn't perform properly. You know, it's you're supposed to throw it so that the football is, as you know, is not round. It has two points. And when you throw it, it's supposed to spin like a little bullet. And the head of the football is supposed to go into the arms of your target person. But I couldn't really throw it like that, and then it would spin end over end, right? Which was the goofiest way to throw a football. And I was the kind of kid who, when we would play football, all the kids would line up and be chosen. So the two captains would say, I'll take Doug, I'll take Steven. And there were always like a couple persons left. And I was like the last one. It's like, well, who's going to take Kurt this time? And I was like, oh, man. You know. And I was quite capable of having a ball come right to me and dropping it, right? But John Lee was an amazing athlete. And in fact, he later became, I think he went to the University of Maryland and became like a, I think he was track or something. I don't think he played football. But he was quite, and as I have found out, or as I found out later on in my life, he actually owned like a sporting goods store for a long time in the part of Maryland where we lived, in Bowie, Maryland. But in the third grade, John Lee was, very physical person. He had a handsome guy. He had broad shoulders. He was muscular. And when we would play football, he was always, if he wasn't the captain, he was the one everybody wanted to pick. And John was, just like an amazingly fast runner, all the things I wasn't. And you know, I remember I became his friend, actually. I don't know why he befriended me, but we actually became friends. And a couple times I would go over to his house, and I met his parents, and they were really nice parents. And then he would come over to my house for lunch and so on. And we had another guy who was sort of in our circle, and he was also very athletic. So I was like the would-be athlete, and they were the real athletes. His name was, he had an odd name. He was, Hagler was his last name, and everybody called him Cappy because his father was an officer in the Army. So the three of us sort of hung out together, and I did get better in sports hanging out with them because they were, you know, they were very good athletes. But I so wanted to be John Lee. You know, it's funny, earlier I had wanted to be Doug, and then at this other school, I wanted to be John Lee. And I just, being Kurt, there was just nothing, no positives to being Kurt. And I think a lot of us feel that way. And so, you know, what we set out doing is trying to be somebody. And we sometimes pick consciously or unconsciously. We pick people we admire, and we emulate them. We try to become like them. And we all do this. I mean, years ago, I noticed that the Dalai Lama was wearing a pair of glasses that had black rims on the top and clear transparent rims underneath. And the Dalai Lama would be in these pictures and you'd see him with his glasses on, and he'd have these glasses that have like heavy black plastic on top and underneath is clear plastic. And then one day I was looking at a picture of Richard Gere, and what do you know? He had a pair of glasses with heavy black plastic on top, you know, and clear, and I'm sure he saw the picture of the Dalai Lama and said, I've got to get those glasses. And that's something we all do. You know, it's very human. When I got to graduate school, or when I got to Rutgers, rather, you know, I noticed that there was this professor at Rutgers who was the most admired professor. His name, he's long gone. His name was Richard Poirier. And he was a scholar of American literature. And Richard Poirier was this very dynamic person. You know, he'd written a number of books. And he had a real presence. And people wanted to be Richard Poirier. It was very interesting. You know, like Poirier came from Maine, like upstate Maine, and he had this incredible New England accent. And it was a little bit hard to penetrate sometimes. So when I first heard a lecture by him, he was talking about modern literature, and he kept calling it modern literature. Maudlin. And I thought, Maudlin, what is the Maudlin? You know, Maudlin. Maudlin? You know, I had, what? You know, but it was actually Maudlin, the Maudlin literature, modern literature, right? But, you know, I began to notice that his proteges, his graduate students, would all start saying Maudlin, the Maudlin. You know, whether they were from Virginia or California, the Maudlin. And they would even dress like him and develop his mannerisms. I actually have a good friend of mine. His name is David. And David is retired now. But he was very, very good scholar and really quite well known. One of his articles, if you go to Google search, it has like 3,000 citations. So, you know, lots of people have used his work. And he was a student of Poirier. Fortunately, he didn't say Maudlin. But he told me that he learned to write by copying paragraphs in Poirier's book. That's how he... So he actually would, like, retype Poirier's paragraphs. And he'd practice being Poirier. See? Being Poirier. And after a while, he became a really good writer. And a lot of people have noticed that his style is a lot like Poirier, because he practiced to be Poirier. Some of his mannerisms were very similar. You know, he had the same sort of strong presence in the classroom. When David came in to give a lecture, you know, David was filling the room, just like Poirier was filling the room. And I've known other people like this too, you know, who set out to be somebody, to be a person. You know, my brother-in-law is somebody I really, really like. And, you know, when he was about 17, he went to study with his uncle, my wife's uncle, who was like a famous sculptor. His name is Paul Suttman. He's a pretty good, very wonderful artist, really. And when Jonathan, my brother-in-law, went to study and spend a summer studying art with his uncle, you know, I began to notice that John was more and more acting and dressing and sounding like Paul, you know. They were living together, and John was like his studio assistant. Right? So, you know, Paul would be making these mock-ups of these sculptures that he would send to Italy, and the metal foundry would take the mock-ups and make a real metal sculpture. And John was helping him with that, and And when I saw John after that summer, he was sort of dressing like Paul, and Paul smoked cigarettes, but he rolled. This was for many people. This is before your time, but at one time, people used to roll their own cigarettes. You could get cigarette papers. You would buy cigarette papers, and you'd get loose tobacco, and you could roll your own cigarette. And this was like. I think John found this habit of Paul's to be unspeakably cool. So I noticed that after John had been studying with Paul for a while, he pulled out a bag of loose tobacco and rolled his own cigarette, just like Paul. And, you know, it's possible to say, what's wrong with him? Why doesn't he find his own way of smoking cigarettes? But, you know, pretty much everything we do we borrow from somebody, right? I mean, it's almost inescapable that we're trying to become somebody, and as we're going along in life, we're sort of like picking up this and picking up that. And this is a natural human thing. I don't hold it against my brother-in-law that he liked his uncle and emulated his uncle. It's a human thing. But sometimes when I see John, Paul is long dead, but when I see John, I see those echoes of Paul and John. And it's funny, if you look at John's sculpture, he's an artist too, as it turned out, he became an artist like his uncle. There's a lot of Paul's work in John's work. So anybody looking at one of John's statues would make, if you knew Paul's work, you'd immediately make the connection. You'd say, "Oh, there's a lot of Paul Sutman in John Sutman's work." See, and we all do this. You know, it's like all of our lives we don't want to be the guy on the field that nobody wants to choose. Nobody wants to choose the last two. Geeks, the last two bookworms, waiting eagerly to be picked, and nobody wants to pick you because you're going to drop the ball. So, you know, we start working on creating a persona or a self, an identity, and we pick people we admire. And this is a natural human thing. There's nothing wrong with this. I'm not criticizing. In fact, all of us have done this. I've done it myself. I've done it all my life. Being a human, to be a human is to borrow things all the time. And sometimes it works the other way, right? I mean, sometimes you become who you are by pushing against what other people want you to be. So my father was very interested in sports. You know, if you went to my house on a Saturday, my father would be watching a game on TV, and he would be eating a sandwich or something and watching a football game and drinking a beer, and you could hear him screaming, right? If, you know, go, no, no! You know, just this bellowing. You know, oh, no, no! You know. And, you know, some part of me, I just said, you know, I do not want to be like that guy, you know. So I don't even watch football, you know. People say, did you see the game? It's like, what game? You know, what, who? Never, you know, I have no problem admitting I don't like football. I don't even watch football. It was sort of like a decision I made, or like, that is not what I want to be. I don't want to spend my Saturdays sitting on a couch drinking a beer and watching a football game. So, you know, we all do this, you know, and maybe you had a parent who was trying to, my wife's mother belonged to a sorority, and my mother-in-law's sorority was the same sorority her mother had belonged to. So it was going to be the case that Barbara was slated for membership in the sorority, but my wife was a hippie chick, right? And she was wore peasant blouses and blue jeans, and she wanted to live on a commune. She wasn't going to go into a sorority, right? So they had a big fight, and, you know, my wife deliberately became not a sorority person, right? So this is like a process that goes on, right? And we become we find people whose identities we admire, and we try to become like them. And depending on how strong their influence, that person remains with us in a big way or a little way. And we've picked up habits or attitudes or tastes from people we don't even remember, right? We don't even remember their names, but just you know, when you look at a magazine, you know, every day it seems I get another Land's End catalog. It's like each one is different, you know, and you know, if you look at the Land's End catalog, they have little scenarios, right? It's a happy family in their new cotton sweaters, and they are on a picnic, and you look at that and you think, yeah, you know, I'd like to be that father with that cotton sweater, or I'd like to be that mother with that cotton sweater, you know, or that picnic basket. Where can I get that picnic basket? This is very human, right? There's no other way to become a self except to sort of like start gathering pieces of your identity, right? And identity is so important to us. You know, it's like, who are you? You know, who are you really? And that's really such an important question for all human beings, right? Because nobody wants to be the kid in the playing field. Nobody will pick for the game. That's like the worst fate. That's like sociologists call that social death, right? You don't want to be socially dead. You want to be alive. You want to be a person. You want people to respond to you. So, you know, all of this is healthy and all of this is good, but actually, you know, in a certain way, you can be trapped by this process. You know, little by little, you know, you become like a more, you could say, complete person. So I'm sure that when you were 12 or 13, you know, this process, you were just getting started on this process. But, you know, by the time you're like 40, 45, or 50, you know, your identity is very much sort of like fixed. If you're not very careful, it's sort of fixed, or it's sort of, you've sort of arrived at the person you're going to be. Some people see this as positive, but actually, in many ways, you could look at it in a negative way too, right? It is an achievement to be a person, you know, to have tastes and to have likes and dislikes. You know, maybe you like blues music or jazz, and you know, you come home on the weekend and you play jazz music, and maybe you like Indian food, and you go out for Indian food with somebody you like, and that's you, right? You can say, that's me. Jazz on Saturday, Indian food, and this is all good in a certain way, but if we're not careful, you know, we get locked into that. We become good at being a self, but there are limits to being good at being a self, right? You know, there's another aspect of life which is almost like the opposite of this process. You know, it's almost the opposite of this process of like building a self. And that is like on building a self, right? On building a self. On building a self is sort of like, you could say, there's a very strong dimension of on building the self in Zen and in Buddhism in general. Because even though as humans we need to create a self, you know, in a certain way, every time we make one of those decisions, you know, like I'm going to like football, not soccer, or I'm going to like classical music, not jazz, it's like we're closing a little door in ourselves. It's like closing a door. And, you know, by the time you're 45 or 50, a lot of doors in yourself have closed, right? And, you know, life tends to take on a kind of sameness or a kind of sameness, or you suddenly, you know, I remember I was a TA, a special TA in an anthropology course. I was an English graduate student, but I was assigned to help an anthropology professor teach writing to his students. And his name was Stephen Harrell. And Stephen Harrell was an anthropologist of China. He was one of the leading anthropologists of China. And he was about 40 or 50. And he had published like 3 books on Chinese villages. I think he did some research in Taiwan, a Taiwanese village in transition. I think that was his book. And he got up one day and he started lecturing, and he actually said, you know, he told his students, you know, one day he had realized, you know, this is my life, and he said, I kind of thought to myself, is that all there is? And I think people go through that moment at some point in their lives, and I think it shows us that there's something about building a self that's, you know, only it's okay, but it's not everything. You know, the unbuilding the self is very important. You know, it's a natural human thing to create an identity, to create a self, and to make these choices. But they, in a certain way, they lock us in. You know, we become, you know, people will say, oh, don't tell me, you know, you're going to Florida again for the summer. And, you know, you're going to, yes, I am, I'm going to Florida again for the summer. You know, there's a way of thinking about the self as a really positive accomplishment. And I think we should think about it that way. But also, you know, there's something bigger than the self. And, you know, Buddhism is trying to get people to say, okay, go ahead, it's okay to develop a self, to be a self. But, you know, that's a very limiting process, ultimately. You know, there's this other way of experiencing life, which is stepping outside the self. Right? Getting outside the self. And, you know, meditation is all about getting outside the self. And, you know, when you... last night, we had two people who... an older Sri Lankan man. He was an older Sri Lankan man, but he was younger than I am. And he had his college-age daughter with him. And she was going to Rutgers, I think, because she had a big R on her shirt. And many years ago, maybe 15 years ago or 10 years ago, he used to come here and sit and meditate. And I didn't recognize him at first because he had put on a little weight and his hair had turned gray, right? But I realized when he introduced himself who he was. And he brought his daughter, and he was going to do meditation. And, you know, it was a challenge for him to do meditation, and it was a challenge for his daughter. And, you know, some of that challenge was the physical challenge of sitting on a cushion. But, you know, some of that challenge, his daughter, for example, sat for about 15 minutes, and then she stopped sitting, and she brought her legs up. She put her feet on the ground, and she brought her knees up under her chin and put her head on her knees. And after a while, she went back to the meditation posture. So I don't think she had sat really long enough to be physically uncomfortable. But what I think was happening to her is that she didn't know how to experience this not having a self experience, right? You know, when you're sitting down on the cushion and you're watching the breath, it's interesting for a while, but eventually, you know, you enter this place where self-referencing disappears, and or self-referencing starts to disappear. And, you know, if you've been working very hard to be a self, that can make you very nervous, right? Makes people nervous. You know, we used to teach, I used to teach meditation over in Princeton on Tuesday nights. And it was so interesting because, You know, the Princeton students would come to practice meditation, and I'd show them how to meditate. They often had negative reactions to the meditation. It was interesting to me, because I'd say, how was your meditation? And they'd sort of screw up their faces like they'd eaten a lemon, right? And they'd say, well, you know, or I remember there was one guy, he was very athletic-looking, tall, very handsome man. And at the end of two sessions of meditation, he actually looked like he wanted to punch me. And I don't really know the whole story, but it was like rather consistently, the students at Princeton would come once and they wouldn't have a good experience and they'd go away. And of course, we've had this meditation group here at Rutgers for something like 25 years. And you know, Rutgers students would come and they would give it a try. And, you know, some of them wouldn't come back, but a lot of them would have, like, a big smile on their face. Last night, Anton brought somebody who hadn't done this before. And, you know, she might have been faking it, but she smiled. And she said, that was very interesting. And I actually believe her. The students at Princeton didn't even try to do that, right? They just looked sour and unhappy. So I think maybe it's possible that for some reason, you know, like the students at Rutgers liked that experience of getting outside of themselves. And the students at Princeton, and not all of them, of course, but a lot of them, I think, had worked really hard at being a self, you know. When they would come to sit, they were dressed very carefully and self-consciously much of the time. And I think they had spent a lot of time sort of taking care of themselves, developing a self, right? Big project for them. And I think Rutgers students were a little bit different in that regard. I think they were more open to the experience of not having a self. And that's the Zen way. So, Nansen came to see Hyakujo. Now, Hyakujo is Wangbo. Wangbo. Nansen is Nanchuan. So, Nanchuan came to see Wangbo, and Osho means like monk, priest. Zhou said, is there any Dharma that the holy ones have not preached to the people? Nansen said, there is. And then Zhou said, what is the Dharma that has not been preached to the people? Nansen said, it's not mind, it's not Buddha, it's not things. So, you know, if you become a monk, you know, if you're in the Tang Dynasty and you decide to become a monk or nun, you definitely have an identity, right? I mean, basically, you shave your head, you leave your family, you go to live in a monastery, you get a new name, right? Like, you get a name like Wangbo, right? Which was not his family name, that was the name he was given when he became a monk. And, you know, monks and nuns also pick up identity, right? Pick up identity. So, if you want to be a good monk, you have to be good at being a monk. You have to, you know, I was talking to Jaru in the car when we were driving over here this morning. You know, there's Zen monks and nuns wear what is called, in formal settings, what is called a kesa in Japanese. It's like a gold robe you wear over your black, brown, or sometimes ochre robe. And if you go to a monastery and you're a new monk there or a new nun, you know, and it's time to put on your kesa, your ceremonial robe, every monk in the temple would be watching to see if you know how to do this. And there's a whole ritual to putting on your robe. You have to unfold the robe a certain way. you have to hold it up and then you refold it. And you have to fold it so it goes over the right, over the left shoulder, and you can hold part of the robe on your sleeve. I'm not describing it very well, but it's quite complicated. And if you don't do it right, every monk in the temple will think you deserve to be the last kid on the baseball field who doesn't get picked. Because you know that's a sign that you've become an accomplished monk. You know how to put on your kesa. And if you don't do it right, they'll be all saying to themselves, tisk, tisk, you know. So even monks have an identity. Even monks have to like create an identity as a monk, be a good monk, right? Nonsense kind of saying, Nansen came to see Hyakujo. Hyakujo is Wangbo. And Nansen is the student of Wangbo, Hyakujo. And Joe said, he's asking the younger monk, Nansen, is there any Dharma the holy ones have not preached? Nansen said, there is. Joe said, what is that Dharma? Nansen said, it's not mind, it's not Buddha, it's not things. So, you know, really, it's often said that basically Buddhism is about mind. Buddhism is about Buddha, right? And basically the point here is, you know, you can get attached to your identity, and it's important if you are a monk to be a good monk. You know, put your robes on right, wear your kesa properly, observe the precepts. You know, when we eat Orioki style at sashin, it's important to sit straight, watch the bowls, don't put your elbows on the table. It's not an informal meal, right? Be a good monk. But if you just live for that, you know, you're missing out on the biggest part of your life, right? Which is not being a self, right? And so, you know, to practice Zen is always like cultivating being a stranger to yourself. You know, when we sit, you know, we're actually sort of like preparing to be for the stranger to show up, really, you know? That's really what we're doing. And it's a wonderful way to live, right? It's like, okay, I have a driver's license. It says Kurt Spellmeyer. It lists my age and my street address. But, you know, when I sit down on the cushion, like on a Saturday, I'm going to encounter something like a stranger. You know, there's an aspect of my life that I don't know anything about yet, right? It's like some of you may have read the wonderful book On the Road by Jack Kerouac. I don't know if you've read that book. And Jack Kerouac was not really a good Zen practitioner, right? But Jack Kerouac understood one important thing about Buddhism, you know. Being the liberating power of being a stranger, of meeting the stranger, right? I mean, in the 1950s, Jack Kerouac hitchhiked across the United States. He hitchhiked from basically New England all the way to California. And he made all these friends on the way. And I myself have hitchhiked, you know. And I don't recommend it now. If you are a little too young to have hitchhiked, please don't try it because it's a different world. But when I was young in the 70s, mid 70s, you know, I actually towards the end of the 70s, I actually hitchhiked across the United States myself several times. And you know, you get up in the morning and in those days, it used to be possible to stand at the on-ramp to the interstate. And you could have a sign or you could just have your backpack and you could stand there and put out your thumb. And people would pick you up. And you didn't know who was going to pick you up. And they would take you, maybe they were only going 30 miles, And that's okay. You get a ride 30 miles down the road, and they drop you off at the next off-ramp, and you walk on to the on-ramp. And maybe they're going 300 miles, and maybe they're going all the way to California, right? So I would get rides with people who were going 30 miles, but I would get rides with people who were going 300 miles. And they wanted me in the car so they had somebody to talk to and wouldn't fall asleep. And we'd stop at restaurants, and they'd buy me lunch. And sometimes they invited me to their house to sleep at their house. Some people offered me a joint, which I accepted because I hadn't taken vows not to do that yet. Truckers, those poor guys have to go for, like 24 hours driving. And they would love to have somebody in the car who will just talk with them about anything at all, just to keep them from crashing, right? So a couple times I got rides with long-haul truckers, and they'd take me to the truck stop, and, I'd never been to a truck stop. It's a different world, And people took me out to their ranches. There was a guy who picked me up in his car, and he took me. He had a ranch out in Arizona. It was a wonderful thing, not to be Kurt Spellmeyer for a while. Just to be going with the flow, just to be seeing what opens up. Where is this taking me? And if you want to be a good hitchhiker, you can't have any expectations, right? You can't say, I'm going to be in San Diego by tomorrow. Or because there are days when you go out on the road and nobody's picking you up or no cars are coming. You can get dropped off on an off-ramp and you might wonder if you're going to die there of starvation. So that can happen too. But that's, part of it. You sit there, you're waiting for your ride, and you look around, and you suddenly look at the Teton Mountains, and you realize, it's really beautiful here. I'm so glad I'm stranded here. So, the Zen life is about unbuilding the self, right? It's about stepping out of that game or that process, and not having an objective, right? Not trying to be a better self or a better person or anything at all, but just being open to possibilities, right? There's a stranger inside of yourself who's going to present herself to you this morning on the cushion. And you don't know, you begin to at first, you're a little bit like that Princeton student who got mad. When the stranger shows up, that can be annoying, right? I don't want to meet you. I'm happy with who I am. This is a waste of my time. I've got a project all lined up. This is my schedule. I'm getting my Princeton degree. I'm going to go to law school. I'm going to work for a New York firm. I don't want to meet the stranger, right? But this other way of living is constantly to go back to the stranger in yourself, right? And every time you sit down on the cushion, you enter Mushin, what can happen then is really an open question. And especially when you're working with koans, things will astonish you sometimes when you're working with koans. It's like, where did that come from? We're not always receptive to the stranger, but we learn to be receptive to the stranger. I was training with a Zen master, a Japanese Zen master, and he gave me a koan, which is not in the Momonkan, one day at a Sesshin. He said, I want you to tell me about the voice of the raindrops, because it was raining a lot. And I went back to my cushion, and I was sitting, meditating with this koan, voice of the raindrops, and I just kept saying, raindrops, raindrops, raindrops. And, after like a day of meditating, or a couple days of meditating on this, I felt like what I really needed to do was just to go in express my experience of the rain to the Roshi. But when I got into the Dokusan room for the private encounter with the teacher, I said, my koan is, what is the voice of the raindrops? And he said, yes. And I said, well, I become the raindrops when I listen to the raindrops. There's no difference between the raindrops and me. And he was quiet for a minute, and then he said, oh, that's okay, he said, for an answer, but let me give you my answer. And then he jumped up and he went around the room going, you know. And you know, God damn it, that was the answer I wanted to give. But I was still standing on the ball field wanting people to choose me, right? Instead of being open to the possibility, right? It's okay, you know, I wish with my whole heart I had just gotten up and made a rain noise and run around the room the way he did. I didn't trust the stranger in myself enough, right? And there'll never be another moment like that for the other moments, right? Other moments. So you know, one way to think about this is that Yakujo and Nansen, you know, are both accomplished, right? They're both accomplished. But the older monk is warning his student, you know, don't put too much stock in this being a good monk, right? Be a good monk, but there's something beyond being a good monk. You know how to fold your kesa, you know how to put on your, you know how to stack your bowls and so on, but don't let that prevent you from meeting the stranger again and again. You know, this is really all about meeting the stranger. We have a temple, we have robes. You have to have some kind of a social role. You have to have some kind of an identity, you know. But don't get trapped by your identity, even if it's monk, even if it's Zen master. You know, life is bigger than that. And we just, every time we sit down on the cushion, we're opening ourselves up to the unknown in ourselves. And believe it or not, you know, it's the unknown in ourselves that connects us to everything. And it's the known in ourselves that, in a way, cuts us off from everything. You know, we put so much energy into being a self, but being a self actually cuts us off, right? It's the unknown in us that connects everything to everything. So what have the holy ones not preached? Well, you know, anything the holy ones have preached is part of is not very useful to you. It's necessary, but now not so useful. It's what the stranger has yet to tell you that's liberating, that's connecting, that you need to hear. Nansen came to see Yakujo. Joe said, "Is there any dharma that the holy ones have not preached to the people?" Nansen said, "There is." Joe said, "What is the dharma that has not been preached to the people?" Nansen said, "It's not mind, it's not Buddha, it's not things." Joe said, "You just preached." Nansen said, "I'm like this. How about you?" Joe said, "I'm not a man of great wisdom. How can I tell if there is preaching or no preaching?" Nansen said, "I don't follow you." Joe said, "I've talked quite enough for you." So they're both demonstrating their openness to not knowing, right? They're both saying, okay, we're not going to spend too much time with what we know, with our identity. We're going to live for the stranger. Secho's verse, "Ancestors and Buddhas have not preached, yet monks run after preachers because they think the preachers are like Richard Poirier." The monks want to say modern, right? "Clear mirror on the stand, sharply imaging, looking southward, see the constellation, the Great Bear. The shaft hangs down, where do you find it? Saving your nostrils, you have lost your mouth." So the great way is always to be a little confused, trying to hear the voice of the stranger, but not quite hearing it.